That's time is important.
Thank you.
Are you sure we're live, Scott?
Yes.
All right. Good morning, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Call, coming to the 12th floor of the Capitol today. It is May 9th, 2013, for a work session on case number PU 13-51, Telrite Corporation, designated eligible telecommunications carrier. I don't have any comments, or I probably won't have any questions either. I would just ask if Randy or Julie has anything, and then we'll turn it over to Patrick.
I have no initial comments, but probably we'll have some questions.
Okay.
No comments.
All right, Patrick, your nickel.
Well, okay. Commission had an informal hearing on this application, and there were a few things that we, there was a bit of information that was requested from the company. We received those things recently, and as soon as we did, then I said that I would bring it to the commission to schedule a work session, and here we are today having the work session. The things that were asked, requested from the company, kind of as late filed information, one of them was market data that Commissioner Fedorchuk had asked for. Mm-hmm. And we asked for the company to clarify the areas that they were intending to provide service through in North Dakota. There were appeared to be some voids in the area that they were serving and some uncertainties, so they filed an amended Exhibit A, which essentially appears to us that...
One second, Patrick. Did you get us copies of that you're referencing?
You should have received copies of it when it was docketed.
Okay. I don't
it's
have
docket
it.
Number 11.
Does this include the marketing information, too?
That was that came in separate, and okay. That information is docket number 10.
All right.
Just for Randy and Julie, too, I know that...
I'll share with Brian.
Well...
I'm sure I have it in my files.
Well, but that's where I've had this challenge before, too, is I usually have John take the list of 1 through 11 and go through here. But I may not even have that today either. But that's sometimes what happens is the clerks won't... Something will get docketed, but they won't necessarily pull it off unless they double-check.
Okay.
So, based on that, let's see if I have it. So the question you had, though, Julie, is you just want to look at it?
Yeah, I just want to have copies of what he's looking at.
So this is...
Here we go.
This means this is 11,
yep.
Right?
There we go. Here's 11 right there.
And then 10 we need?
Oh, 10 was the market data that Commissioner Fedorchuk had asked for. Do you
right
have
there.
That at all?
Oh, cool.
Yep.
10 is. Okay, thank you.
As far as the application and the area that they intend to provide this lifeline service appears to be now the whole state of North Dakota. They provided a map, coverage area map. And they listed all of the exchanges in North Dakota in this attachment. And they also included then a certification by Ryan Lyle, president of the Telrite Corporation, certifying to the sort of like we do certifications in siting cases where they certify to the requirements for being designated as an eligible carrier.
So they basically have signed up. They agree with everything we're asking for, right?
Yes. I haven't actually studied this yet, but that's the intent of it. And for staff, I'm just looking to at this work session just to hear what the commissioners are thinking about this application, and for staff direction, if you need any more information, we'll see how we can pull that together.
Sure. Well, I guess from my point, Pat, is the we've now received several of these, and I've got some concerns about how they do business, but they're all My concerns are nothing that we really address in each individual hearing. It's a broader concern about these companies coming in and doing the things they're doing, but that's what the law allows them to do. So I don't have any particular concerns on this case. I'm ready to vote for it, if you will. But that's where I'm at right now, I guess.
Patton, looking at this map.
Yes.
I can't tell the difference in the legend between moderate and no service available. It looks to me like the same legend. Okay, this one's better. So,
is yours black and white, or is it
yeah,
color?
Yeah, but no, I just handed this color one. So that's that's a little clearer, but does it seem like the no service area is primarily is in some of the areas where the most lifeline qualified people would be? Especially if you look down south and west of where we're sitting right now.
I wouldn't know that for sure. It's always been my impression that no service areas may be areas where the terrain is difficult or where it's very rural and there aren't very many customers.
I think especially the second one.
The part of the challenge, let me just expand what Randy's asking, because that's somewhat my comments were is that it'd be nice if we could direct these to certain areas, but they can kind of pick what they want to serve the way the law lays out right now. And that's some of the challenges that we've got a FCC ruling that lets them, as long as they've got an approved plan, they no longer have to have a storefront in North Dakota. They can pick the areas they want to serve. And so we could have 20 companies serving one area and no companies serving another area. And that would all be legitimate under the federal law. And there's nothing in the state law that would challenges that's been upheld.
When we designate an ETC, it's for a study area of a company that they can choose the company's study areas that they want to provide service in. In this case, they're choosing the whole state. And then I think, you know, what you see as far as the coverage is really a reflection of existing
infrastructure,
existing wireless carriers, and those carriers are also designated as ETCs.
So I try and think this thing through, and as you stated about that, it's not particularly about this company, it's about this industry.
Right.
And when I think back, I still recall the first time on the floor of the Civic Center when a friend handed me a cell phone that was about the size of a brick and about that heavy. And I don't remember who I called, but it was something important. And I said, I'm standing here in the middle of the Civic Center talking to you. It was such an astounding thing to have that cellular service. And I wasn't tied to the wall anywhere. And I'm walking around the Civic Center making this phone call. But up at Hazen, we couldn't do that. It was in Bismarck. And then all of a sudden, it got to be Hazen, but it wasn't out at the farm. And, you know, now this map has gotten pretty dark, but there are still areas unserved. And I know in the past, the commission has done things to try and get service in unserved areas, but we know that these players are not going to invest anything into the infrastructure that is still lacking in the state as a whole. And that's something that bothers me with this. Another thing that bothers me with it is, and this has nothing to do with Telrite individually. We know that not all basketball players are tall, but a lot of them are. And we've read the articles about this program being ripe with fraud around the country. And so what do we do about it here? Do we just welcome any of them that come in with an application? I'm not sure. And those are just comments. My question for Pat is, on this Exhibit 11, you know, not counting the cover sheet, the first page after that, explain this distinction. On number 2, it says, Telluride will utilize the federal low-income universal service support. Then number 7 says, Telluride is not seeking universal service fund high-cost support as part of its application.
Sure, the difference there is number 2 is talking about federal low-income universal service support, low-income support. Number 7 is talking about universal service fund high-cost area support.
Are those two, like, completely separate programs and separate funds, or are those two programs that take out of the same fund?
That is a good question. That's a question better answered by Universal Service Administration Company, I think. I can check into that and see if I can determine the answer from the website, from their website.
Is the question, just so I understand the funds we're talking about, the federal low-income universal service support is Lifeline. That's the Lifeline program, right?
There is a Lifeline program, yes.
That's it, the federal low-income universal service support.
Number 2. Yes, and I believe they are separate funds, but I would have to confirm.
And so the question is whether that Lifeline comes out of the broader universal service fund or not.
Correct. Whether
right?
It's just
is that what you're asking, Randy? Whether Lifeline program comes out of the Universal Service Fund or if there's a separate stream pool of money for it.
That's generally, just to be clear, Lifeline isn't the only low-income program, though. There's LinkUp, and I don't know if there's more or not, but that's not really.
Aren't we talking about Lifeline here, though?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But yeah, that's generally what I'm getting at. If it's a real distinction or if it's a distinction without a difference, because mm-hmm. if they come out of the same pool.
Right.
Can you clarify something for me, Patrick, on number 12 in that certification document? Telluride acknowledges that it may be required by the FCC to provide equal access to long-distance carriers in the event that no other ETC provides equal access within Telluride's designated service area. What does that mean?
This requirement has been around forever for ETCs. This, the way I read this is that if there is no other ETC providing equal access in this area that Telluride wants to serve, Telluride should know. Are you familiar with the term equal access?
I thought I was, but okay. It doesn't make sense to me in this context of a Lifeline provider.
Well, equal access is 1 plus dialing to the long-distance carrier of the customer's choice.
Okay.
In this area. Okay, so if there is no ETC providing equal access in the area already, then the FCC may require Telluride to do it. And they acknowledge that they understand that.
Is this a real concern, or do generally these ETCs provide equal access, all of them?
In North Dakota, I know that all the landline companies do, and I believe all the Verizon and AT&T Wireless, I believe they do as well. And I think those are the major players. So I don't believe it's a problem. I don't believe Telluride, if they don't already provide equal access, which I guess we could look in the application, see if they do. But if they don't already, there's somebody that is.
Yeah. Okay. I was just curious. That was more of an educational question than something I'm concerned about with this application.
If I could, just some broader thoughts to maybe answer some of Randy's questions and maybe yours, Julie, that the Telecom Act of 96 really basically set the stage for complete deregulation of telephones. And so we started on this road many years ago that we'd deregulate everything, and the state's authority has continued to be reduced in this area. We find ourselves in the middle of approving things like this, which really we have no say on what the rules are around them. And then we're facing the backdrop of we want to increase cell services in North Dakota, but we have no jurisdiction over cell phones. So we've gone out and we've held Zap the Gap meetings, and so we'll go hold a Zap the Gap meeting in Community X. We'll get signatures and we'll get petitions, and then we'll meet with Verizon and AT&T and anybody else, and then sometimes they'll provide service, sometimes they won't. But we can't mandate them to do service. And then the fraud issue you talked about, if the way I see fraud is that no matter if any telephone service, if there's fraud and we become aware of it, we do just like we did with that company in Oregon. We became aware of some potential fraudulent dealings with a company that had access to North Dakota networks. We worked with the AG's office. They verified it was true. We pulled their numbers away, and now the AG's office is continuing to go after that company. So if we become aware of anything, then we investigate it. So if these companies, Telluride or anybody else, if somebody said there was fraud in them, we would investigate it, work with the AG's office, and potentially pull away their certificate. So we've done that before. And then the backdrop of removal of universal service funds to all these companies is going to become a big issue. And I think that providing rural services for cell phones and the smartphone apps is going to become a bigger and bigger issue that the commission has to face. How we're going to try to make sure the person in Fargo has access to the same thing as a person in Botno. But the reality is it's been deregulated, so they're not going to have equal access because that's what it was set up at. So that's the backdrop that I don't have an answer for you. The issue is like if there's fraud in something, I'm pretty confident that if we become aware of it, we'll do the right thing. It's just that there's a whole thing right now that the horse has left the barn on telephones, and we're in a tough spot sometimes where we find ourselves situations like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the answer, not a answer, is we've got to get more involved at some of these groups, you know, like through the NAROG Telecom Committee. They're the ones that go testify in front of Congress and do those things. If we've got, you know, work through our delegation, that if we don't like something specifically, we've got to get it to them. And we've signed letters that all three commissioners, if we don't like something in a particular program, North Dakota Public Service Commission doesn't like this, and we'll send it to everybody. We did that on the infamous cap and trade. We've done that before on coal ash. So if there's something particular in telecom that we don't like with this program, we can certainly do that and send that in there. So that's just kind of a broad dump, I guess.
Go ahead, Randy.
Do we have the authority to add requirements onto these in order to grant ETC status? Or do we either just grant it or not grant it based on the rules that are laid out by the feds?
We do have authority to add conditions to granting ETC designation. We have a rule currently in place that set the last time we reviewed, you know, the requirements that the commission wanted to have, we put that into rules, and so it is a rulemaking action that we would take to do that. But we do have authority to have additional requirements.
Were there once requirements for infrastructure investment?
There used to be, the way I understand it, that the companies had to have the storefront in a state to provide services there. And then when the FCC changed some of the rules, now if a company has an approved plan by the FCC, they don't have to have the storefront. That's the way I understand it. That's been the big change on this.
Well, the requirement used to be that a company, in order to receive ETC designation, had to be providing the service with their own facilities or their facilities and a combination of other facilities that they obtained through wholesale agreements. The FCC lifted that requirement for this type of ETC designation where they're doing lifeline only, wireless ETC. They lifted that facilities requirement. But they also have to have a compliance plan that they file with the FCC and approved.
But is there something that you'd like to see additional in these orders, Randy? Because I'm open to, you know, if we do it for one, we do it for all of them. But if there's something particular that you'd like to see added, I'd certainly be open to that.
I'm not sure how to frame it, but I know the answer is yes. I would like to see some kind of a requirement that some of their returns be invested back into infrastructure in the state. That's how we grew this in the first place, grew our system. By everybody just living off of someone else's investment, but no one ever making a new investment, we will slowly creep down a path of falling behind in the digital divide instead of being in pretty good shape in the digital divide across this nation. And so I guess I just start off with this issue against these companies that we know are just taking the profits and leaving and have no intention of investing anything into building out the system. And if this state map were completely dark, bright orange, I guess I wouldn't worry about it. But seeing that we still have a ways to go in infrastructure development, I'm not sure we're ready to start allowing players into the system that don't do anything to enhance our infrastructure.
Well, in this particular, with this particular type of application, now the FCC has intentionally lifted a requirement for facilities, that the company have facilities. So I'm not sure. And they've said to us, you can designate companies. You know, the states are doing the designating, and they say to the states, you designate these companies without, even if they don't have facilities. And so requiring them to invest in facilities may be contrary to the FCC's order.
And are we sure that it's contrary? I mean, did they say that they don't have to, or did they say, you not only don't have to, but no one else can require you to either?
Oh, well, I can provide the language for you.
What kind of now, I hear what you're saying, Randy, but I'm struggling to understand what a storefront is going to do for improving our system.
Well, I'm not talking so much about a storefront, but I'm talking about, you know, it's primarily AT&T and Verizon that are the two big players here. Mm-hmm. So you have about a certain number of, you do have a limited number of people who qualify for Lifeline. Obviously, there's some profit in this system and what the Universal Service Fund pays for providing this, or we wouldn't have these people applying to get in the business. So if those profits are distributed between AT&T and Verizon, and we know that they have a record of investing into infrastructure, it's not about the storefront, it's about the towers and the T1 lines to the towers and everything that makes it work. If these variety of companies that operate on the order of Telrite take half of those customers, then that is that much less money that Verizon and AT&T will make in this state that they will have available for infrastructure development. That's my theory. I don't know
now,
if I'm correct.
Isn't
or not.
My understanding of this, how this all works, and it's pretty elementary, but that anybody who's using these companies would have to use the infrastructure provided by AT&T and Verizon. Therefore, they're paying them for that, and so AT&T is profiting from them, and that's where the investment comes back. So I don't think it's necessarily realistic to assume that every company that comes in here is going to be putting fiber in the ground, because it would be duplicative and not that efficient. So on this particular service, which is, it seems to me like the margin of profit is so small, I don't know that it's realistic to assume that they'd have much left to invest in actual infrastructure and what is being, but to the extent that they have to pay these larger carriers to use their infrastructure, then I think they're contributing to the investment in the system in that way.
That makes an assumption, and I don't know if it's right or not, but it makes an assumption that whatever rate the government has decided is appropriate for AT&T and Verizon to charge for using their infrastructure to these third-party carriers is profitable. They might lose money on every one of them, too. I don't know the answer to that.
They may.
I don't know where that's
probably a decision that the government's made to serve low-income people, saying, and if that's the case, I've looked at what the requirement, you know, what are we supposed to be looking at? What are we required to look at in designating, making these designations? And, you know, there's five different things here. And then the final one is the public interest standard. Prior to designating an eligible telecommunication carrier, the commission determines that such designation is in the public interest. That would be the only area where I would see that we'd have room to say, no, this isn't in the public interest. For me personally, I would have a hard time telling Telrite that it's not in the public interest for you when the commission in previous years has approved it for others that met these other qualifications. So we're changing the standard. Effectively, we would be saying, and I don't really like picking the winners and losers. If they meet these five criteria, which from what I can tell they do, and I was comfortable with their presentation that they are going to be, you know, taking care of the customers and operating by sound business standards, I'd be hard-pressed to reject their application. But
the Pat, steer me back if I get off course here. The on cases like this where we don't have a formal hearing, we just have an informal, that becomes all the places, the basis of our record we make decisions on. So the questions that you may be asking now that maybe we don't have the answers to, those are questions that if you have a hearing or an informal, that's the best time to ask those questions right to the company and say, hey, you know, what do you say when I say this? And then you give them a chance to respond, because otherwise then we're just kind of – so if you want more information, Randy, I would say that, you know, I'm hearing Julie and I might be ready to vote for this thing, but I'm hearing you're probably not ready to vote for it. But if you want to take your questions – and send them back to the company, that's appropriate, I think, isn't it, Patrick? I mean, certainly
we can look in, you know, public documents for answers to commissioners' questions, and the FCC documents may help provide some information there. But any other questions that are specific to, like, Telrite, the commission can hold another informal hearing on this case if they want to.
Because where I'm going with this is, okay, let's say that we decide to vote against this, 3-0, and we just because of what we decided here in our discussion, we go against it. It goes to the next level of review, and they say, okay, what did their commission base their decision of no on when there's nothing in the record anywhere that reflects anything we made our decision on? And then it would get overruled because we didn't have a good basis for making a decision. So anything we can get in the record, if we're going to go that way, really is helpful. And that's where sometimes informals, if we have concerns about, I guess I should speak for myself, if I have concerns about something, I'll request a formal hearing, advice and informal, to really get flesh out all these questions early. And that's typically the best way to do things, because if we find ourselves with this many questions now, it's really hard to get the answers when we're in this discussion here.
But I presume, and this is a question, yeah. So my avenue would be to make sure that Pat is on the same page and understanding my questions, and have Pat contact the company? Because I presume I'm not supposed to really be contacting the company.
No, absolutely. I would
separate from the other commissioners.
What I've done for myself when I've had questions is that I will lay out question 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'll give it to Patrick and say, Patty, I need the answer to these questions. And then Pat will do whatever. Either he'll find it himself in the record that's already there, or he'll go back to the company and get the answer. In this case, since there's not any interveners, it's pretty easy to move information back and forth. And then we're going to have another work session that the specific questions that you asked today that maybe we couldn't answer or couldn't be answered, then they get answered at that time.
I share your concerns on the fraud side and your concerns on how this program is marginalizing the Universal Service Fund in general. I feel a little like I have two hands tied behind my back because it feels like bigger powers are controlling those decisions. But maybe there's some avenues through NARUC and through other commissions that this is a passion and a real interest of yours, and you've got a lot of experience in this area. We could pursue moving forward. What are our powers, and how can we get our arms around this, and how can the states be helpful in the efforts to fraud? Because I know South Dakota approaches this differently. I don't know enough about how they do it, but Georgia's looking at doing some things. The Georgia Commission's is looking at doing some, you know, adding some elements to theirs. I'm open to that type of approach. I just don't feel like I have enough information on it and experience. And I feel like I don't understand the timeline enough to know how long can we sit on this one while we kind of get this other stuff figured out. But I'm open to your thoughts on it, too, because I do share some of your concerns. It's just I don't know about. I feel a little bit like we're holding this company hostage. They've gone through the process, and I don't know that there's anything alarming in their application that really concerns me, you know, that I feel like they aren't going to be providing good service other than general concerns about this isn't a program I really love.
So do you have some questions that you want to pursue on?
I would like to, if we can work on this for...
Why don't we do this? If you could get a list of if you could get a list of questions that you want to ask, and then give that to Pat, and then we'll get a chance to look at it too. But Pat, if you could also prepare this for the next meeting that we're going to vote for it, or a motion for it, and then we'll decide come closer to meeting time what we'll do. Because it could be such a thing that you get the questions to Pat, Pat gets them answered, you get to look at them, you're comfortable to vote for it. It could be such that you don't want to vote for it and we still go forward, or we just say let's hold one more work session for us to talk about it again. But I think that, for me, I don't think we have 2 weeks literally till the next meeting. That should be enough time, I think, if you can get your questions to Pat to get something back. And if not, for sure, the last meeting of the meet that this not the next meeting, but the following meeting, I think we'd want to bring it up for some kind of vote. That sound good. Reasonable?
Sounds very reasonable.
So that
reasonable.
Gives us at least 2 weeks to work with that we can maybe get resolved, and then for sure a month from now we're voting. And they got the company in the room. That sound reasonable for your time frame? Fair enough. So... to Julie's point, though, and yours, Randy, is that the broader issue of telecom is, I mean, that's why I'm excited that you're on the NARUC Telecom Committee, because just like we have this meeting at 10 o'clock today in MISO, we have all these states trying to work together to figure out transmission, and I don't like where some of the stuff is going in national transmission planning, but as an individual state, I will get rolled. So I got to get South Dakota on board and Minnesota on board and Montana on board. And that's probably what I'd say that we should do is we should start reaching out to South Dakota and Minnesota and Montana with our concerns. And then we could file a letter to the FCC on behalf of all the states. We do that all the time with transmission lines. And we send them in there, and then we have the beginning of why we're not don't like something. Okay. Julie, any other questions?
Nope.
None.
Sir?
Thank you.
Pat, does that give you enough guidance for what we're doing here?
I'm going to get something from Commissioner Crispin and go over to the commissioners to see if I can provide some more information that's available publicly or or else request to the company and prepare an order, just to have it ready.
Yep.
And
actually, why don't you put it on the agenda? And what we'll do is, if we're ready to vote on it, we'll vote on it. If we're not ready to vote on it, I'll just ask for it to be held over to our next meeting. That way, we'll plan as if we're going to vote on it, but any commissioner can just ask for something to be held over. So if we're not comfortable to vote on it and we think we might be getting resolved, we'll just hold it over. If we don't think there'll be resolve coming, maybe we'll just vote on it.
When it's held over one meeting.
Correct.
Oh,
yeah, good point.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's not held over indefinitely. It's not like putting
so
the table.
It's different from withdrawing it from the meeting.
Right.
Holding it over, it means it goes back on again the next one.
So if I asked to have it held over, and the next meeting comes back up, Randy asked to have it held over, and the next meeting you ask that, that's legal?
That's possible.
All right. Going once, going twice?
Hold over permission.
All right, that's not our goal, right?
No.
We'll close the work session on case number PU 13-51. Thank you all very much.
How long are you going to be?